Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist, and you'll find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com, or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we are all about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which lie at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are difficult to predict, sometimes even difficult to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead and that will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I'm super fantastic. How are you, my friend? How are the holidays treating you?
Very well. It was a good Christmas. Good Christmas morning. I accused my sons of hacking Santa's computer to get on the nice list.
Whatever works.
Yeah, exactly. It's very pragmatic. You know, whatever works for them. But yeah, it was a great time, and we had a good time with the family and everything. I wanted to thank you for Rocket Man. That was very nice, Bill.
I'll tell you what, we can maybe have a show where we talk about Rocket Man. In fact, I'm going to be referring to it a couple of times this evening, so I think you'll enjoy that book. The book we're referring to is Rocket Man. It's by Craig Nelson, not Craig T. Nelson, Craig Nelson, and it is the story of the voyage to the moon, and it's a wonderful book because it gives us the really delves into the historical background of what led up to it. A lot of surprises along the way, and just kind of the insider view of what was really happening when you're seeing all these iconic images of the rocket blasting off and the Neil Armstrong stepping out of the lunar excursion module. All these things that we think we know, and in fact we do know, it really provides a kind of a rich background to all of that. And increasingly, I look at the Apollo program as a real high watermark to date for humankind in a lot of ways. Not just because it was this wonderful technological achievement that was in some ways ahead of its time. I think it's one of the great examples, one of the all-time great examples of something going from being just an idea, just a fantasy, really, to actually becoming reality. We do the shows once in a while about what I call practical time travel, and to me this amazing feat of space travel is a fantastic example of practical time travel. So anyway, having said all that, hope you like the book, and Merry Christmas.
Thank you very much. I'm sure I will.
Got any big New Year's plans going on there?
Well, yeah, I'm just getting together with some friends here locally, and it'll be fun. We'll get out there, we'll do some fireworks for the kids, and hang out and play some games and things like that, and just have a good time with some buddies until the New Year's rung in. How about yourself?
I don't know. It'll probably involve bottles and diapers. That seems to be pretty much.
The party life has changed slightly for you here recently, hasn't it, Phil?
It really has. You know, I thought it had changed a lot when we had one. When you got three, and they're all under three,
you might not even be awake as it happens when the New Year's rung in. You might be awake between three and four, but
exactly. Yeah. Well, oh yeah. All hours of the night. Sure. Exactly. Some of the same hours I used to keep when doing fun things, but it feels very different. Is all I can tell you. Doesn't feel the same.
Great.
That's probably age, but it can also be what you're doing. You know, there's a lot of explanations for that. But anyhow, looking forward to it. Looking forward to Yet another year of Fast Forward Radio. I think we're gonna have another great year coming up, and I think we've really closed out the year very well at the Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio with the discussion that we had last week that was so good and that led to your wonderful post over at the Speculist that I thought we should just pick it up this week and talk about the coffee shopification of everything. It's such a seemingly vast concept, Stephen. So let's talk a little bit about what coffee shopification is. Excuse me, I just dropped something here in the virtual studio. I dropped a physical object in the virtual studio. What is coffee shopification, and why is it going to apply to everything? I think this actually stems back a couple of weeks when we were talking about the demise of real bookstores. And how we see that as a shame, but as an inevitable consequence of the availability of digital books, and that ultimately what happens is the bookstores go away and what gets left is the coffee shop. Just about every big chain bookstore I know has a coffee shop attached, right? The Borders always did. The Barnes & Noble I go to has one. We got a small chain here in Colorado called Tattered Cover. They've all got the coffee bars going on. And it's like what you'll see is that's the piece that survives, and people can come together and talk about books. But the physical inventory of books goes away, and what remains is the coffee shop. And then that idea got carried over to our discussion last week about the future of higher education. And pick the story up from there, Stephen, or correct the record if I've misstated up to this point, and tell how we got to the coffee shopification of everything.
Well, I have nothing to correct. You got it right. With universities, the idea is this, that when knowledge is being given away, then all that the university has left is credentialing. Okay, I mean, if MIT and others are giving away the knowledge for free on the internet with open courses coming from Harvard, I believe from Yale, maybe from Stanford, I think Stanford, MIT, and even Khan Academy, the knowledge is becoming available to anyone who has the self drive to get out there and learn it. It's available to you. Now, so what's left? Well, the credentialing. You could take all the Khan Academy you want, and then take all the attend more virtual classes than any MIT graduate attended in real life, and then you still don't have a diploma from MIT. MITx is the beginning of some form of credentialing, less than a diploma,
right?
But showing that you've completed these online courses, and once you start down that road, where the credentialing is also available, even if it's a lesser credentialing, can you imagine? Then you're an employer in some out of the way place who's looking for candidates to fill certain slots. And he's got a couple candidates in front of him. One who's from MIT, has certificates from MITx, and then one that's gone to the local school there and has a diploma. The difference between the two, the main difference between the two, is the level of student debt held by one versus no student debt held by the other. And so it comes down to this: who can I get cheaper? You probably can get the one who doesn't have student debt cheaper, because he simply, doesn't have anything to pay back, whereas the other candidate has to pay those things back. And so, why do that? If you feel comfortable that the MITx candidate knows what he's supposed to know, then you'll end up taking him. And so that's what happens to the local schools, especially. The big schools, they survive because they are the big schools, right? You get MIT is going to be with us, Harvard, Stanford, places like that. But what about local schools? What about the college just right down the road from wherever it is you are? my thought is that they're going to struggle, and it's going to be a different world for them in the next 10 to 15 years. And one possibility is that they just kind of become tutoring centers for students that are learning through other avenues, online or whatever. And so your thought is, wow, that sounds like a big coffee shop. Well, yeah, it could look a lot like a coffee shop.
Just like what happened to Barnes & Noble, right? You took
the
books out. What's left is the coffee shop, right? So you've pulled the classrooms out of the university, and what's left, right? I mean, if you've pulled the instruction out of the university, what's left? Well, yeah, it starts to... You know, it starts to feel like, I mean, maybe we should clarify this. When we talk about the coffee shopification of everything, we're not literally saying that the University of Wisconsin is going to be offering mocha lattes, right? I mean, we're not actually saying that it turns into a coffee shop. What exactly are we saying, Steve?
We're saying that it's really going to be a more open source kind of deal where people come, people go. The student that pops in, on Monday to get some help with a particular course that he's struggling with online, you may not see him again for a month, or you might see him every day. It just depends on, it'll be a lot like, going into, get that cup of coffee at Starbucks. Some people do it every day. Some people do it once a year, that's kind of the, and so it just depends on how much that particular student feels like they need it. And so everything becomes a lot more informal and maybe goal oriented. It's not like I have to, I'm not clocking in because I have to anymore. I'm clocking in because I need help in this particular area. And so maybe I'm not expressing myself adequately, but I think that's what we're talking about when we say coffee shopification, at least
absolutely. Well, it seems to me that there will be different levels of institutions being stripped down to the basics, that there will be different basics that they get stripped down to. And as we discussed last week, some institutions probably won't survive at all. They'll just go away. But if you take a typical state university that is now undergoing tremendous pressure from competitive sources, such as credentials offered by providers of free online content, especially this very, well-branded free online content, when you're talking about it coming from MIT or Stanford or someplace like that. But even if new means of certification arise, such that if there are independent standards bodies or independent certifiers who will get together and say, okay, well, you've taken some MITx, you've taken some Stanford, you've taken some Khan Academy, come take our test, and essentially clep out of college, and we grant you certification. That I think that there will be potentially a number of possible certification models that will be competing with the degrees that these institutions have provided, all of them maintaining this tremendous overhead associated with instruction. And it's just like the overhead with the bookstores, as we said, and that's the piece that has to go. So what's left? Well, I think, as we said last week, for the big prestige schools, that won't go away. They'll keep that. Other schools, that has to go away. It gets replaced by perhaps some kind of sponsorship or tutoring of those things. Universities will still be in the research business. In fact, what we might see is some universities become primarily that they're more about institutes of research than they are institutes of higher education, which would be an interesting model. Here's the thing we didn't talk about last week, and it's huge. What happens to the sports programs?
Yeah. I mean, when you got, for example, you've got LSU. Football.
Right.
You talk about a state that's eaten up with just love for LSU football. Where do the Tigers go when there are when the university itself has changed to something quite different? I think there's so much love for the team and for that program that will continue to be state supported even when the university's gone. That's what we're talking about. I think some huge programs like that may hang on longer than the smaller schools. You know, and again, if you're talking about just a neighborhood school that has like 5,000 to 10,000 students, their sports programs just go away. But you know, these huge schools, maybe somehow they manage to hang on, maybe becoming semi-pro. You know, who knows? But it'll be a different it's a different world. And think big guys hang
I would
on.
Suggest one of the possibilities there is that we will finally recognize college football for what it actually is, which is
professional football. Yeah.
It's minor league professional football for NFL. In fact, it's very well paid minor league, very well funded, very successful minor league program. But that's what it is. It's the minor leagues, and I think that they will, even if universities primarily go out of the teaching business, and a lot of them end up just being kind of these state institutions that stick around, those teams will continue to exist, and maybe we'll just, you know, we'll do away with this fiction that these people are students at these universities, and we'll recognize that they're professional athletes going through, you know, a brief minor league professional career before they go into the actual NFL. And I don't think it would change that much. You know, the stadiums will still be there. People will still have that long affiliation with them. What happens is if you don't have the student body and you don't have the quote-unquote college experience after a decade or two, that might start to dwindle. And then who knows what happens with those programs. But I think you make an excellent point that they would be one of the last things to go, right? You know, the classrooms might go, right? The library was going to go.
I just can't express to you how much this state loves, you know, the Tigers. I just can't. It's just an absolute. And if you've never been to a game, a college game on the level of that, well, I mean, quite honestly, there's nothing like it. The games measure on the Richter scale, and I'm not even kidding. They measure on the Richter scale in Baton Rouge. It shakes the city. It's amazing. It's amazing how how much it's just a tremendous amount of fun,
they're hardly unique. You know, I mean, the University of Nebraska, same way, right? Just this huge thing, and there are also a lot of like smaller schools, state schools, private schools that have that same thing at a smaller level, but very firmly entrenched and. I think not likely to go anywhere. Anyway, that's a bit of a digression from the overall topic. But when you start talking about stripping institutions of higher education down to their bare bones, that's
hey, we're talking about what's really important to people here.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. That's one of the things that's definitely going to stick around. Okay, so that's what happens. The university becomes a quote unquote coffee shop. It becomes a stripped down version of itself that's supporting this ad hoc education. It's more in a support role now for certification than perhaps even granting certification, although universities could still maintain the certification business, and they could say, look, we're here to help you through your MITx, Stanford, whatever, even our own online material. So they end up still conferring degrees, but without actually providing the coursework. It's that expensive overhead and faculty and classrooms and all that stuff that I think ultimately disappears.
It's not just faculty. Actually, that's not where the growth has been as far as the overhead over the last decade or so. The true growth has been administration. It's been out of control. I mean, it's just getting more and more and more expensive to the point that you go, you get your degree, and you're left with student debt that you're paying off until it's time for your kids to start getting student debt. It's insane, and that's got to change. And I will mourn the loss of bookstores more than the loss of the current university machine. It's saddling so many people in ways that's just not fair, and it needs to be reformed. It really does. does.
It's,
so
it's become,
I won't cry over that.
Yeah, it's become a beast. It's ready to change into something else. Let's talk about some of these other things. You know, we're seeing the coffee shopification of everything, and we talked about universities last week. So what else gets coffee shopified?
Well, we talked about offices last week, and you know, I think it's interesting that the office really kind of started as a coffee shop in a way. Think of Lloyd's of London. You know, I mean, that was literally started in a coffee shop. You know, you had a bunch of shipping magnates there betting on whether ships would make their ports and deliver their cargo. And then, you know, somebody got the bright idea, well, what if I bet against my own ship making it? You know,
right.
That way, if my ship makes it, then I'm rich and happy because my ship made it. And I lose my bet, but it's not that big of a deal. And if my ship doesn't make it, then I'm still rich and happy because my bet pays off big because it was kind of a, you know, it's a long shot that it wouldn't make it, right? So
right.
That was the beginning of the insurance business, and that was in a coffee shop. So so what I'm talking about is actually, you know, let's get back to the basics here. You know, can we have a coffee shop again at work? Well, you know, yes and no. I mean, obviously, you know, you can't discuss private business in an open setting like an open coffee shop necessarily for every single thing, you know. But, you know, when you're talking about a world where there's just groups that are being brought together for particular projects, they disband, and then you get new groups brought back together, and these groups can be brought together in a flash because you have, you know, the Internet. I mean, you just you have the ability to get these things together quickly, then what do you need? You need the ability to set up quickly and, you know, operations quickly in all sorts of places, all around the country and around the world, really. And what do you, you know, and what does that look like? Well, it could look a lot like a coffee shop with maybe some private offices that you rent by the, you know, by the day or whatever attached to it. So that's, I see perhaps that we may be moving back to coffee shops for our work team. So not a bad
Amazing.
Idea. Not a fun, and not, it seems a lot more fun than a cubicle. That's my thought.
I think so too. I'd rather hang out at a coffee shop than a cubicle any day of the week. It occurs to me that one of the ideas we haven't expressed yet is that coffee shopification alone might not account for all of the kinds of changes we're talking about here, or that there might be other terms that could equally be used or that might describe aspects of the kinds of changes we're talking about equally well. For example, you know, I can imagine this big kind of Venn diagram with a lot of things overlapping, and I love the image of the coffee shopification just because you get this idea of, okay, we're stripping everything out, and what's left? Coffee shop. It makes perfect sense, and I love the Lloyd's of London story where the workplace begins as a hangout, right? Like a place people went to drink coffee, and some people are going to be they're going to be wondering, why can't it be the barification, you know? And I'm sure there will be a certain amount of that going on. But I did a piece on the future of offices over at Transparency Revolution a while back, and this is we did a poll on this. One of the things we talked about was what happens to offices, and we didn't talk about them evolving into coffee shops necessarily, but what people did come back, the large majority, as I recall, came back and said was that offices, we know them, just won't exist. That's a big piece of overhead that businesses can function without. And one of the things you might describe this as, in addition to the coffee shopification, would be it's the webification of the workplace. And come to think of it, an awful lot of what we're talking about around university is kind of the virtualization or webification of the educational experience. It's also part and parcel with the homification of the office experience. You've just got a lot of people have moved their workplace to where they live. This is the whole telecommuting revolution that people make their workplace their home. So the office is being it's being coffee shopified, perhaps it's being webified, it's being homified. All of those are major processes that are kind of working together to tell us that the workplace is going to be tremendously different, I think, in the very near future from what it is today, and that whatever is left of the quote unquote office is, to your point, probably going to resemble more like a temporary space where people get together and you know come together probably for more or less temporary projects. I mean, one of the things we talked about last week was the kind of increasingly transitory nature not only of work but of a career, that that in order to really stay competitive, increasingly to stay competitive in our economy, in this environment, people have to be a little bit ahead of the curve. They have to be coming up with the next thing that, A, no one else has thought of, and B, people will buy, and C, hasn't been automated yet, and won't, and that you have 18 months or so before somebody does figure out how to automate it or outsource it or make it impossible for you to make any money off of it. With all those factors in play, you're looking at not just a different workplace, but really a very different kind of economy. And to support that kind of economy, yes, the workplace is going to be substantially different. It's going to be about bringing resources together, about achieving things in a very short period of time, about having this kind of competitive edge, kind of this ability just to work off, you know, off the fly. And you know, I think the coffee shop really provides a great image of what that might be.
Well, and I think the coffee shop and the home would work hand in hand in this new economy we're imagining, because, you know, you can't have clients to your home. You know, the typical person, you know, normally that's not going to happen. And
right.
And also there, you know, Phil, I mean, with young kids, you can imagine sometimes the distractions of home are just too much. You can't get any work done, and so I think a lot of those who feel that they, you know, can't get the work done at home, where are they going to go? They're going to go someplace like a coffee shop that
I can tell you right now. I can tell you right now. I work from home, and I work with partners and vendors who work from home. And whenever we get together, it's at Starbucks. It's always at Starbucks. It's always like, you know, I mean, once in a great while we'll have lunch or something. But usually, if we want to have a working session, that's what we do.
They don't come to your home.
Three or four Starbucks
I
hit all the time.
Yeah. They don't come to your home. You don't go to theirs.
Right.
You'll go to a place like Starbucks. Yeah. Starbucks depends upon people like you. I mean, that's probably a good portion of their business during the workday, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I'm a good citizen. I buy a big old coffee when I get there too.
My question. This is completely off the subject of where we were going with this. But let me just ask you. What is it to keep Starbucks and other coffee shops, you know, that are known just for being coffee shops, what's to keep them from completely just taking over Barnes & Noble's business, you know, by, you know, installing a print-on-demand book printer? You know, I mean, you go in, you get your coffee, and I want to get that latest Patterson novel. And, you know, you hit print, and you sit down and enjoy your coffee. By the time you're done with your coffee, you've got your book. I mean, it seems to me that's a good model.
That's a good question. I mean, you know, what you're suggesting, and you talk about this print-on-demand book idea in your blog post at Speculist. What you're suggesting is, to an extent, Starbucks doing to Barnes & Noble what McDonald's has done to Blockbuster with its little DVD renting machines, right? I mean, it's
exactly.
Like you. Yeah,
Blockbuster is just. I mean, they're done. I mean, and it was and all it was is these little vending machines. And you know, it's amazing.
Well, Netflix,
simple concept.
Of course.
Yeah, in
that point. But I mean, that was a nice little piece of pie for McDonald's, and they already had the infrastructure. They already set up. You know, it's like you add one little vending machine to your business, and you take a huge chunk out of somebody else's business and make a nice pile of money for yourself. So I guess the question then is, how viable is this book on demand idea? And I know we got some pushback on that idea in the comments to your blog post. So let's talk a little bit about that. How does that work exactly? I believe you mentioned that there are actually shops where you can go into and you can say, give me, you know, For Whom the Bell Tolls by Ernest Hemingway, right? And I'll print you out a copy right there on the spot.
I love the name of it. This book machine is the book machine is Espresso. So it's got a coffee reference right there in the book.
There you go, right there. Yeah.
The Espresso book machine, you would step up to a monitor, and the monitor wouldn't necessarily have to be right next to the machine. If you want the machine in the back where it's not seen and not heard, you just would step up in the coffee shop to a monitor. For Whom the Bell Tolls, whatever, the latest novel, whatever you want, you pick it out. And, instead of getting just an e-book, the e-book is sent, is sent to be printed. And it's printed on, it's got a paperback cover.
Right.
And it's printed, it's glued in, and what comes out is, basically the standard trade paperback, which runs, about $14 in normal bookstores. Is that about right, Phil?
I would think. Sounds right.
It's about that. And it's printed for a penny a page. And we had someone in the comments say, a penny a page? That's way too much. I don't know where he's been buying books lately, but a penny a page, a typical 300 page book, unless my math is wrong, that's $3. And, of course, the coffee shop would add on their profit, and you'd also have to pay for the e-book, right? So, what we're talking about is something in the range of $5 to $10. You are undercutting the trade paperback by at least $5 or $6, right?
Right,
so,
right.
And basically nothing ever goes out of print because it's printed right there, right? Any book that's ever been thought of could be made available provided that the rights could be had, and so you could literally have the biggest bookstore in the world with no foot space at all, except what about three square feet for the espresso book machine, basically is what we're talking about. And basically you'd have the biggest bookshop in the world because anything is available. So
wow,
that's a big deal. And obviously that machine could get better in ways like it could get faster. You could choose perhaps your own print size if you need a larger print. Maybe you like a particular font, things like that. That could make it nicer. You could customize things a little bit more. But you can see that coming. Those are easy additions to the technology that's already present. So,
the thing that interests me about this idea is. And this shows how far my thinking has come on this subject over the last couple of years, because we've got our infamous bet that I won't reference again. But I'm not even sure that this would work, just because I don't know that there's enough demand going forward for print books. I mean, once you've made the leap and you're okay with electronic books, who wants all that paper? Who wants the hard copy? Now, I realize there are still plenty of people, and we saw in the comments, there are plenty of people who say, oh, no, I a lot of that same gut reaction that I had about
yeah.
books, I'll never be able to make that leap. I'll always want to hold a book in my hand, and I understand that, and there's something to that for now. But, I don't know how long that lasts. I guess this actually kind of goes hand-in-hand with what we were saying about the kind of shorter and shorter life cycles for business models, because if this does pop up and become a business, if people really start viably making money having instant book printout, I think you're right. It will get a lot better. It will get really interesting what you'll be able to do in terms of interesting covers and different kinds of paper and different sizes of paper and different colors and all kinds of things you'll be able to do in printing out these books. But I also think that relatively speaking, it's not a business model that will last particularly long, because for one thing, ultimately that capability will be homified, and then there won't be any reason to go out and print your own books. You'll be able to print your own books at home, and they'll be undercut by the fact that this mid-level technology always seems to find its way ultimately into the hands of the consumers, and once that happens, it's just like at one time there was a viable business around charging people money to print out their laser copy for them, right? If you could go, you know, rent time on a laser printer, and that business has been gone for a long time. And I think that likewise, this would be hot for a period of time, and then maybe not so hot, except for, again, probably at the higher and higher end in level of the world. But this kind of speaks to retail overall, and you talk a little bit about that. Now, what are you suggesting when you talk about retail outlets becoming coffee shops? Are we at the level of the, if not the universal assembler, like the mega powerful fabricator at that point, where people are going in and they're just ordering anything that you can imagine and it's being made while they wait? Is that the idea?
Well, I'm actually talking about basically a 1-2 punch that knocks out Walmart. Okay. Now,
okay.
There's a 1-2 punch that knocks out Barnes and Noble. And the first punch is the ebook, and the second punch is print on demand. Okay. Or maybe it's the other way around. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Those are
right.
The two punches. Okay, I'm saying that the 1-2 punch that knocks out Walmart are Amazon Prime and things like that, where
yep.
You know, you can order anything in the world, and it'll be at your door, you know, in 2 days with shipping free, and then that's the one thing, and then the other thing is that you know, a fabrication, 3D fabrication, where you know you just order something and it can be printed in perhaps a local regional fabrication center, and you go and pick it up, and that's and you can get that day perhaps. That's I say those are the 1-2 punch that knocks out these mega, huge, expensive Walmart stores that you know. Absolutely, the amount of real estate that a single Walmart takes, you know, and then you know, add Target and add all these other, you know, the warehouse clubs and everything else. It's ungodly, and can we knock that out? Yes, I think it will happen. Quite frankly, it's just not a pleasant experience to go fight the crowds at those places, particularly during the holiday season. I ended up using Amazon Prime for probably 90% of my Christmas shopping.
I'm trying to think of anything other than like some chocolates, and I didn't, just at that level, right? A few little like chocolates and things like that I
yeah.
picked up at the store, and everything else, every single other thing I bought, I ordered online, and the vast majority of those things, virtually all of them, I ordered off Amazon. So. And actually, that's interesting, because what you've got there is that is the homification, right? That is the webification / homification of the shopping process. But then you're taking it one step further, and you're talking about not just the procurement of the goods, but now we'll talk about the production of the goods, and
right.
and production and procurement get moved to a coffee shopified environment, potentially, where you can where you can fabricate stuff and you just show up and get whatever you need. And again, it's going to be mid-level stuff, and
yeah, 3D printer. See, you can go and buy a 3D printer right now for about the price of what a laser printer was in the mid-80s. Okay,
right.
But they're very limited in what they're able to produce for you. Those machines of, you know, in the $5,000 and less range can't do much for you. It's mostly a hobbyist's kind of thing. What I'm talking about is fabricators that would cost tens of thousands of dollars, maybe hundreds of thousands of dollars presently, but that would be able to produce just a wide range of goods and could produce them quickly. And another thing about the, you know, additive manufacturing, that's what this is. 3D printing is additive manufacturing. There is very little waste in the production of goods this way. And so for about 10% of the material that it takes to produce something in a traditional manufacturing environment, you can produce it this way. And basically you are attacking the economies of scale too, because, you know, that's the way it's always been. You know, the more we can make of anything, the unit costs go down, right? Well, if you're able to produce, if any size run is equally cheap, then
right.
you don't have to produce, you know, not everyone has to have a black Model T anymore. You know, you can
right.
You can produce anything a consumer can imagine can be produced and produced just as cheaply as a huge production run. So that becomes a big deal. And so perhaps you could see a Walmart in your local area just going out of business first because of things like Amazon, and then that facility being turned into a huge fabrication type system where they can fabricate just about anything. You could you could put a fabrication machine in a building of that size to probably roll cars out of there. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I was just gonna say this is where I want to talk a little bit about the coffee shopification, the homification of the factory, because in your piece you talked about it from kind of the standpoint of the consumer experience. That's sort of how we're looking at it. And
yeah.
I think that's appropriate because obviously a coffee shop is very much a consumer experience. Plus, that's how you and I experience these things anyhow, right? As consumers, I mean, we're not academicians, so we don't experience the university from that end. We have been students though, so we've seen it from that end, right? We're bookstore patrons, and we're customers of retail outlets, increasingly exclusively Amazon, right? But there's an interesting B2B middle step here when it comes to the, I'm not sure what it is, the coffee shopification, perhaps the homification of the factory. And I want to read just a little bit of a comment that I got from Will Brown over at Transparency Revolution, our good friend Will Brown over at Where There's a William. I had written this piece called Keeping Up, and this was a blog post just about the fact that, we've got to stay ahead of the curve. We've got to define markets. All the stuff we've been talking about. And Will writes this. I know that Will is in the manufacturing business. I know that's where he works. And he writes, "We're in a very frustrating interim period between established manufacturing formats right now. A modest commercial grade fabricator runs about 15K. So that right there, I'm interested, Stephen, between what you and I were thinking about in terms of the hobbyist printer and what you were talking about in terms of something that produces something viable. He's talking about you can get something for 15K, about what a new baseline car or pickup truck costs. While there's a readily available market of credit and business opportunity for the latter category of purchase, you pretty much need to be able to front the cash for the former, in large part because there is little common recognition of individual business opportunity attached to private ownership of such a machine." And you know what? I read that and I said, damn it, Will, you're right, because I have no idea. What is the individual business opportunity attached to private ownership of a machine, right? You know what I'm saying, Stephen? If somebody showed up tomorrow and delivered a fabricator to your house and said, okay, good luck, enjoy, right? You know, I wouldn't know what to do with it to make money with it, would you?
you go rent your space in a local strip mall, I guess, and hang out a shingle. We fabricate everything, you know. I don't know.
We sell stuff. Yeah, you know, you're the public, right?
Stuff
for sale. Come see if we can make
stuffification. We're stuffifiers.
The stuffification of your ideas. Show me an idea, I'll stuffify it. I'm not sure. I'm thinking that because Will's coming from a manufacturing standpoint, that he's actually talking about providing specific products, probably into a business context. Like I don't know what it would be, machine tools. I don't know, but I think we should let's make a footnote here. Sometime early in 2012, let's get Will on, and I want to talk about this idea because he goes on to talk about how somebody needs to educate people, and you can actually create a market for people buying these fabricators and kind of setting up shop and starting businesses around owning these fabricators. And because I'm not able to get my head around what exactly they would be selling, I'm initially hesitant to be the guy, poning up the first 15K to make it happen. But I think if we can get Will on to talk about it, I think he might persuade us that there's something here. Anyway, I thought it was a cool response from him because it talks exactly about what we're talking about, which is people taking that one next step. And there were people 25, 30 years ago, maybe a little longer than that, who bought personal computers and started doing amazing things and making business for themselves out of the fact that suddenly there was this computing available that wasn't available before. I think there's probably something like that at work here as well, and I think we should have Will on to talk about the I don't know what it is. Is it the webification, the homification, the coffee shopification, whatever? It's the future of the factory. But something that's exciting to me about this, the more I think about it, one of the things that is consistently bemoaned about our economy, you hear this all the time. In fact, I've been hearing this. This is one of those things I've been hearing, like, it feels like my whole life, you know, since I first became aware of the news or analysis of the economy or what's wrong with, you know, America or, you know, any of that kind of hand-wringing stuff that you hear, is that we're losing our manufacturing base, that we don't manufacture as much stuff as we used to. And I mean, you know, it's like that's been going on for years, for decades. That's been going on. People have been saying that. And we need to get back into manufacturing. Real wealth is associated with manufacturing. Of course, you and I, we've talked about all the issues surrounding that and whether the real value lies in the information or whether it lies in the actual products. But just putting that whole discussion aside, it seems to me that if you take coffee shopification to the next step of homification, you want to talk about an ambitious program for reintroducing manufacturing into America, right? We're talking about potentially a factory in every home, right? This would be the golden age of manufacturing, right? If we ultimately work it into that direction, and the only problem is if there's a factory in every home, does anybody have any reason to buy anything from anybody else? I'm not sure that it necessarily saves the economy, but
What you sell then is the information, because
right.
You know what you come up with in your garage, it's. It may be a better idea for how to use the 3D printer than anyone else has come up with, and so you sell that information and let everybody else, print out your idea. So I think that would be the thing that would be left that could be sold and be marketed would be the information.
Hey, Ken and Jeb are giving me ideas for what I can do with my fabricator if I buy it. How about customized chess pieces? How many customized chess sets do I have to sell to offset that initial $15,000?
A whole lot.
Investment?
I would say that
personalized knickknacks. But you know, I can see it. I mean, I can see a business there. But you'd really have to, you'd have to crank out quite a bit of stuff because I see those as being fairly low ticket items.
Yeah,
I
don't think the future is in these $15,000 machines. I think that the future in fabrication is going to be higher end than that. There's going to be the home fabrication machines, and then there's going to be the machines that can fabricate everything, including very large items. And those will be a heck of a lot more than $15,000. So.
Well, then Jack comes up with a couple ideas that I think have a little more legs. He says pieces of plastic that join one manufacturer's lens to another to another's camera. I've seen quite a bit of that. Is that kind of like specialized stuff? I can see somebody doing some really high volume, you know. If you come up with the one gizmo that makes something work with something else that nobody else did, and you're able to just mass produce that in your home, I can see something like that work. But Jeff got the ultimate answer there at the bottom: dollar coins. Perfect. Yeah. Talk about making money.
I'm sure the Secret Service would have no problem with that.
Just crank out 15,000 of those, and you've already broken even, right? You're on the gravy train from that day on. Well, I'll tell you what. Let's bookmark this. We definitely want to bring Will onto the show and have him make the case for the $15,000 fabricator, because I want to get his take on what the business opportunity there actually might be. I feel like this is one area where we need to spend some more time learning about it ourselves, Stephen, because we kind of talk around it. We need to get in a little bit tighter with the maker community and some of these folks who are kind of on the cutting edge of this. And we'll start with Will. He's the guy who's putting it out there. He's got this business idea. So we'll bring him on the show and quiz him about his business idea and see if we can't, you know, make him a very wealthy man.
That's right. That's right. I would like.
He'll be grateful, I'm sure.
Absolutely, put us on the board or something, you know. Yeah. That's
right.
Awesome. Well, Phil, looking at a couple of New Year's stories, did you see that NASA? You know, here's the amazing thing about this. I learned about this today. How is it that I didn't know about this before? NASA has these probes that are going to be arriving on the moon New Year's Eve, the one probe, and then its twin probe will land on New Year's Day. And their mission is to measure gravity variations on the moon. And how is it that I didn't know about that? Maybe I'm just in the dark, but did you know about this before?
I hadn't heard anything about it, and I presume it's just that no one thought it was newsworthy since we've been to the moon so many times, and these are they landing or they're going to be in orbit?
They're landing.
Okay, I mean, that's pretty cool.
Make sure I'm right about that. Scheduled to arrive on the moon New Year's Eve and
go.
New Year's Day. So there you are. It's they're landing. I don't know. When was the last time we landed anything on the moon? We crashed something into the moon a few years ago to determine if there was any water in a crater. Maybe that was the last thing we had, land on the moon at all. It's just not done that often. So
I think it's very exciting. We're landing stuff on the moon. And what's it doing? It's testing the gravity of the moon. What are the point of these? And why are there two of them? Do we understand what's going on?
It's one of these deals where they have to work in tandem. It's sort of like in a way, it's like depth perception. The two sensors that are separated by a pretty big distance on the moon will work together to measure gravity variations on the moon. And I think one interesting aspect of this is that I believe, if I'm understanding this article correctly, is that they believe that the gravity variations on the moon may have something to do with the fact that the moon may be actually two bodies that came together at one point and kind of melded into one. And so you've got part of the moon that's a different density perhaps than another part of the moon. And so that's why you have these unusual gravity variations that they want to study closer. Maybe it'll help them determine better the origin of the moon. They say there's lots left to learn about the moon, and I believe I'm certain that that's true. So,
well, speaking of lots left to discover on the moon, I don't know did you see this story that Glenn Reynolds linked earlier today? SETI to scour the moon for alien footprints. I thought that, speaking of what a rich treasure trove of potential learning that the moon is for us, and I think the point's well taken. We have everything yet to learn about the moon. We've just barely scratched the surface, literally, just barely scratched the surface of knowing anything about our nearest neighbor in space with the missions that we've sent and the photos that we've taken and the samples that we've brought back. But it's a big place, the moon, and we've so far had a pretty small footprint. So just in terms of the geology of it, the origin of it, what it's made of, what's there, what kind of opportunities there are ultimately for us to live there, to take resources from there, to develop energy from there, all has yet to be learned. And I think the moon represents a tremendously exciting set of opportunities for us today, maybe more so than at any other time, just because we're starting to realize that it's not just an achievement of getting there. There's things to do with the moon, right? There's interesting part of our future probably lies connected with the moon. But here's something else. Here's an entirely different challenge related to the moon, which is that we now have sufficiently detailed photographs of the entire surface of the moon that they can put together a crowdsourced effort for people to start studying these images and look for anomalies and see if we can't find evidence of extraterrestrial life embedded on the moon. So when they say footprints, we're not literally talking about, an alien was walking on the moon and left its footprint, but we're talking about debris from spacecraft that, aren't ours, or satellites that aren't ours, or just any odd artificial anything that's not natural that you find on the moon that isn't one of the known objects on the moon is automatically, potentially, evidence of extraterrestrial life, because we should know every single man-made object that's on the moon. And the picture, the length story here on Discovery News shows it shows an image of the moon, and it shows from the satellite picture, you can zoom in on it and you can see where one of the bases for one of the lunar excursion modules was. And you look at that and you go, okay, well, when I see that thing there, I know that there's something there. It's not just a rock. It's not just a crater. It's a piece of machinery. we know where to look for that one. But there's all this surface of the moon that no one's ever really looked at very closely. So now people are going to start looking at the moon and seeing if we can see if we can find traces of alien life on the moon. I mean, not that we expect aliens to be living there, but that they've deposited their artifacts there. What do you think of that idea, Stephen?
The cool thing about that is that they wouldn't have had to have been there recently, since the moon is doesn't have weather the same way we have weather. I mean, I guess the only weather that they have is solar wind, right? I mean, it's not.
That's right.
Things would be preserved for practically forever, including even literal footprints, if we're talking literal footprints, but they would be preserved for practically forever. And then the machinery and things like that would not rust or decay or anything else. They'd just be there. If we were going to find something that was ancient alien technology, that would be a good place to look. So,
I think so too. This Discovery News, right on this same page, I was telling you before the show started, there were links to these other stories: mysterious space ball crashes in Namibia, Russian dead alien videos. So we've had no shortage of quote unquote alien artifacts that crop up on this planet from time to time, and they I would say always end up being having a mundane explanation for them. Generally, they're hoaxes, and sometimes they're just we don't understand what we're looking at. Well, the potential for hoaxes is zero in this exercise, unless someone has pulled off like the most elaborate hoax you can imagine by actually putting something on the moon,
or manipulating the data. If you manipulate the data stream of the pictures, perhaps, but that'd be tough to do too. So
that would be hard to do too. Yeah, I think it'd be pretty hard to hoax. But the possibility for misunderstanding what you're seeing is vast. So one of the things that I expect to see happening if this thing kicks off is we're going to find a whole bunch of face on Mars type anomalies on the surface of the moon, and people will have no end of fun discovering ruined cities and all kinds of exciting stuff on the moon. But for all that, something interesting may crop up, and I think it's really going to be interesting to see if there aren't some major lessons to be learned about our universe from studying the surface of the moon. I have a feeling there might be. Well, Stephen, that is going to do it for Fast Forward Radio for the year 2011. What is our music this evening?
Well, let's do something upbeat for the new year. March to Victory from DJ Fab.
March to Victory. I like it. That's a good way to get our 2012 going. Well, thanks for putting that together, Stephen. Always a pleasure talking to you. Thanks to our friends in the chat room and everyone listening live. Thanks for being part of Fast Forward Radio. We'll be back again next week with a brand new show. We look forward to being with all of you then. Happy New Year, everyone. And until next time, live to see it.